Welcome to Listen, Learn, and Love, hosted by Richard Osler. The guest on today's show is my friend, Jana Reese. Jana, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Would you take some time and just introduce yourself to our listeners? I know who you are, but will you take some time and just let them know who you are and your area expertise and your status in Mormonism?
Sure. So thanks for having me. My name is Jana Reese, and I'm a scholar of religion. I also am a columnist for Religion News Service. I have a column called Flunking Sainthood, so people may have seen that, for better or for worse. And I have a doctorate in American religious history, have been writing books for a number of years about all sorts of things, some of which were just for fun. I wrote a book about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, some of which are a little more serious. The one we're talking about today is a data-based book on four generations of Mormons, especially focusing on young adult Mormons.
And thank you. And that's a space that I'm particularly interested in and our listeners are interested in. And I think, Jana, you're the reason I started this road of talking about this, because a long time ago, maybe 2 years ago, I was a guest columnist on your article. It was the first time I've ever done something like that. And I felt good about the article you published and the readers that you reached and this ability to talk about complex things in a faithful way. So I think I should just thank you for everything that's happened that I've done in social media and podcasts, because you kind of opened that door and kind of helped me to understand that's a great way to communicate.
I am so glad to hear that and so glad that you did it. I remember that post, and I love having guest bloggers. You are one of a couple of guest bloggers who have then gone on to do other things in Mormon studies and this whole Mormon world. So it's nice to know that that can be a springboard to helping people find their own voices in a new way. So that's exciting to me.
So thank you. Tell us about the book that is coming out in 2019.
Right. So in March of next year, 2019, the book The Next Mormons will be coming out from Oxford University Press. Subtitle still being discussed. We've talked about subtitle of The Rising Generation of Latter-day Saints, The Millennial Generation of Latter-day Saints. So something like that. But it will be out in March, and I'm very excited that it's an Oxford book. Oxford has done such good work in Mormon studies, and I think that it's a great home.
Tell our listeners why you decided to write this book, and remind us again of what number of books you've written, where this is as far as quantity.
Ooh.
That's a hard...
I don't know. some of the books that I've written have been co-written. Some of them have been ones I've done by myself. I think of the ones that, including the ones that I've co-written, were probably up to number 14 or 15.
That's great.
With this, and I don't know exactly how many I've done alone.
And then tell us why you decided to do this book. I assume, like a writer, you have lots of different ideas, and maybe there's 20 books that you'd like to write right now. I don't know if it's that high, but what caused you to decide to really focus in on this book as your next book?
Well, I had an idea back in 2011-ish for a book about Mormon childhood. I didn't grow up Mormon. I'm an adult convert. And I was really fascinated by how faith is inculcated in the next generation. You know, this question of what is a successful way to transmit faith to a rising generation of people? And Mormons have done that pretty successfully compared to other religions, especially in the 21st century, where religion is kind of taking a beating in the world. But it morphed from being a book about Mormon childhood to then becoming more about Mormon teenagers and young adults, because that's what people were interested in, more so like questions of we're losing a lot of our young people. Why are we losing a lot of our young people? What can we do to maybe stem that tide if possible? And I believe strongly that researchers, you can go off by yourself in a room and research something for years, and that's wonderful. But if you have the ability to do something that would actually be useful to people and provide information that could help people, then you should do that.
Very much.
I have a lot of
that.
Idiosyncratic projects I'd love to pursue, but I think this one is important, and it has the potential to maybe open people up to new ways of thinking.
I very much like that. In my YSA assignment that ended roughly 2 years ago, that's when I first connected with you. And in our own YSA ward, I felt like We had 300 on the rolls and 100 were active. 100, their orientation was towards Mormonism. They probably wanted to make it work, but they weren't active in the sense they were coming. And then there was about 100 that probably were not active and probably not too interested in re-engaging. But I had no sort of quantitative framework on what was going on with either of those other two groups, except some of the narrative I picked up along my life. And it was fascinating to me to sort of spend more time with both of those groups to understand better. But I wish going into that assignment, and for all of us that are trying to minister to those that have stepped away, we have more data on understanding why they stepped away. I love this idea, and I've heard you've talked about, is the shepherd knows the sheep well enough to know the backstory on why they left and where they are. Because I think then we're in a better situation to help minister to them. And so that's, so let's dive right into your research, because that's what I want our readers to understand. There's a couple general topics our listeners, I'd like Jana to walk us through. She's done some stuff on LGBTQ, and also some stuff on men and women that have stepped away, with also focus also on millennials. Is there an area you'd like to start first of those three, Jana?
Let's start with reasons why people leave.
Okay.
Because I have that open on my computer.
Perfect.
So just from the purely pragmatic standpoint, we asked people who had left the church. We had a sample of about we had 540 people who had left. We had 1,156 current Mormons. And for these questions about why they left, obviously those went to the people who had left only. And the narratives that we hear in church about why people leave include things like they left because they were lazy. They left because they wanted to sin, engage in sinful behaviors. They left because they got offended too easily by some imperfect person at church or something that a church leader said. And, you know, I suspected that the truth was more complicated. The scholarship about why people leave religion in general, not just Mormonism, but other religions as well, shows a whole host of factors, some of which are personal and familial, you know, family-based, and some of which are doctrinal. And it's never just one thing. I also think that in the LDS Church, we have a bit of an idea that people who leave the church do so a bit on a whim, that they wake up one morning and say, I don't want to do this anymore, or that it's a snap decision. And our data actually didn't show that at all. Most people seem to wrestle with this for quite some time before they step away.
That's very helpful. Keep talking and walk us through the numbers and some of the research. And just so our listeners pick that up, that's 540 people who were once active in the church. And I think your definition of active is at least a year. And maybe you can clarify that, of how you got in to be once active and then left. And that's a big group. And I think that's in the United States is the focus of this study.
Right. This only deals with data from the United States. I would love to see more research done about Mormons around the world and hope that that will be done in the future. But, you know, this is a big enough topic right here.
Absolutely.
And we had a really long survey. It took people about 30 or 35 minutes to complete this. This is a nationally representative survey. It's not a snowball thing where you send it out to people who are in particular social media affinity groups and therefore kind of have that sensibility already. It's a bit self-selecting, whereas what we've done is a fairly formal study, academically approved and as balanced as possible to try to understand both Mormons and former Mormons better.
That's great.
So the top reason in the entire population of why people left was a very general thing. I could no longer reconcile my personal values and priorities with those of the church. And number two was I stopped believing there was one true church. So, you know, those are very overarching, big umbrella kinds of reasons. You can include a lot of issues within those. One thing that I found was that even though we had given people 30 possible reasons that they could choose their top six, these were the ones that they gravitated toward that were more less specific. They're not about any one particular issue like Book of Mormon history or seer stones or even polygamy, although that ranked higher than some of the other doctrinal issues, but rather these bigger things. I could no longer reconcile my personal values with the church. And that's something that I think people in the church need to take seriously. That's not an issue of someone simply waking up one morning and taking offense or going off and wanting to sin, but rather not having their core values in alignment with something that they see at church.
Any examples for our listeners, and I realize this was quantitative, any examples that that come to your mind to illustrate that?
Sure. Well, I did about more than five dozen interviews with millennials who were not in the survey. These are separately chosen people. And the idea behind that was to flesh out the data, you know, to add personal stories to the book so that it would be more approachable. But actually, the interviews began helping me to understand the data in new ways as people explained their stories to me. And some of the same issues cropped up several times, one of which, you know, I know you want to talk about separately, was LGBT issues. And this question of I could no longer reconcile my personal values and priorities, sometimes for people boiled down to that. You know, the church is heavily emphasizing a narrow definition of the traditional family, which not everyone, particularly not everyone in the younger generation, will be on board with. And so that's a bit of a collision happening.
Mm-hmm. That's a good example. Yeah, keep walking us through your research.
Okay, so another issue, number three, was I did not trust the church leadership to tell the truth surrounding controversial or historical issues. And I think that this is important because, again, it's not so much one particular doctrinal issue. It's rather that people are growing up not having heard about these controversial issues and then encountering them later and saying, wait a minute, nobody ever taught me that at seminary. Why am I only hearing this now? And then what else is out there that I didn't hear about when I was growing up in the church? So that's a trust gap. And I think that the church in recent years has made significant strides to try to address that by being more honest about history, making documents available, doing the gospel topics essays. I mean, all of those are really great steps forward, I think, in addressing this issue.
That one is one that I certainly, as I work with YSAs and continue to meet with people, Jana, is really true. And I sometimes think it's, just as you illustrate, it's not necessarily the content they're hearing. It's just that they are hearing it later.
Right.
And they're not hearing it as part of their growing up narrative. I had one wonderful young man serve a mission and testify to people that Joseph Smith was not a polygamist, as he was challenged on that. And then he learned in his mid-20s that Joseph Smith was indeed a polygamist, as we now teach. And that was very, very difficult for him. Mm-hmm. And then it led to just what you're talking about, wondering what else is out there that I haven't quite understood or been taught up front. And so I think that's very helpful. I'm thinking of Elders Quorum presidents and Relief Society presidents and local leaders potentially listening to this podcast and parents that are trying to teach their children in a faithful way. And I think there's very good sort of framework there that we need to talk about these. I think our listeners understand that people, when they hear of something, the first thing younger people do is go to the internet.
Yes.
Maybe even during the first discussion, secretly on their phone, while the elders are talking about some of this stuff. So not only for our investigators, but for our own family members and people we have stewardship responsibility. Any more thoughts along that one, that the information they sometimes hear causes them to have a trust gap? Any interviews or any other sort of insights that you have on that and how local leaders or parents might do better in that area?
Well, I do think it's important for parents, if they can, to try to explain some of these issues at home in a matter-of-fact way. Yes, Joseph Smith was a polygamist, and we don't quite understand why. It is okay to tell your kids and your students, I don't know why. I think I don't know are the three most missing words in the LDS lexicon. There's so much that we don't know, and we often make it worse by coming up with justifications that we think might resolve people's anxieties, but actually in the end often contribute to them.
I like that. I know my own son, we have six kids, and my youngest son is in high school, and he came home one day and told me about some of the stuff he was learning in the essays. I believe it was Joseph Smith's polygamy or multiple accounts of the first vision, and I reached out to that seminary teacher because that's exactly what I hope my seminary teacher would be teaching my high school age son. It seems to me that And I don't know if you have any feelings on this, just from your own experience, what age, it seems like this high school age or late junior high is when you start to introduce some of the beautiful and more complicated parts of our history.
Well put. I like that, beautiful and more complicated, because some of them are, you know, exceptionally complicated, but the beauty is recognizing that complicated and flawed people in history are very much like us, and that we have a connection with them, and therefore we bear some of the same responsibilities that they did. They're not saints in, you know, the lowercase. They may be saints in terms of Latter-day Saints, capital S, but they're not all that different from us.
On Joseph Smith's polygamy, I'm just reflecting a little bit when I became aware of that, and it was Richard Bushman's book, and you could probably remember, Rolling Stone, what's the correct
Rough Stone Rolling.
Rough Stone Rolling, and all of us were reading that on a family vacation, fellow adults and trusted people in my life, and it never really bothered me for some reason that I was learning something in probably my 40s that I'd never learned. And I think one of the things I like to communicate to our listeners, if something doesn't bother you, in other words, I shouldn't project how I process that. For some reason, that was not faith trying for me or faith shattering, but I think it may be for others. So I think one thing for one person that may be difficult, we shouldn't sort of assume everybody should feel the way we do. And
Great point.
I have something that's difficult for me and others don't, I think I need to be felt. People need to give me space to feel that way.
That's a great point.
Let's keep going down your list. This is great info, Jana.
Okay. So again, this is the whole sample. We can talk in a moment about what happens when we break it out by gender or by generation. But number four was, I felt judged or misunderstood. Number five, I drifted away from Mormonism. I'm going to skip down a little bit. Number seven, the church's position on LGBT issues. So that was seventh in the overall sample of former Mormons. Eight was the church's emphasis on conformity and obedience. Tied for eighth was lack of historical evidence for the Book of Mormon and or Book of Abraham. I would point out that's the only specific doctrinal issue that made it into the top 10. And number 10 was the role of women in the church.
It's really interesting. Were you surprised that that was the only doctrinal issue that made the top 10? When I think sometimes
Yes.
our narrative is it's the doctrine of our church that people aren't comfortable with that caused people to leave.
Right. I think that that's very... I was surprised. And when we break it out by gender, we see that those specific doctrinal issues seem to be more important to men who've left the church than they necessarily were to women who left the church for other reasons. I'll just pull that up right now, actually, since we're on it. For women, the number one reason was I felt judged or misunderstood. And that wasn't even in the top five for men. I made this joke the other night that, you know, I once was presenting this information and I said this was the number one reason why women left the church. And a man said something to me like, well, what is it about women that makes them so sensitive and feel that they're being judged all the time? And I just wanted to put my hands on my hips and say, look, buddy, women are judged all the time. This is not in our heads. You know, this is not just a perception. But there is judgment about what women wear. There is judgment about how women speak, when they're allowed to speak, what they're allowed to say. And it's hard to be a woman in the church. It's tough.
If I'm a male leader wondering how much of this, because that's a great example, Jenna, you just shared of this question that someone asked that obviously he was not reflective enough of his own station in life to recognize this question was very much illustrating the problem within himself. Do you have any suggestions if there's male, particularly male people, that leaders, fathers, husbands, that wonder if they have a problem in this area and how to sort of better hear women's voices and understand how they potentially may feel judged?
What a great question. And thank you for asking that. I wish more people would ask that. The number one thing, I think, is to always say, where are the women? Why aren't there women here as we're making this decision? Where are women's voices? And if women are in the room but aren't speaking, solicit their opinions, because they've grown up in a culture where they've kind of been taught that women are support staff. And if you want to hear from them, you might need to be specific about saying, Sister so-and-so, please tell me what you think, and don't be afraid to disagree.
I love that answer. Thank you. The judgment one is really interesting to me. I certainly saw that firsthand as I was willing to listen to stories of those that had stepped away. It It led to my most viral Facebook post, Jana.
Oh, where what was it?
I posted one day after I'd done a civil, I had done a, a couple were sealed, and then they did a ring ceremony, and then I posted a picture on Facebook of me and this couple, and then someone later that week told me that the woman was not wearing her garment in the photo that I had just taken and posted on social media. And the title of my post was, "Is She Wearing Her Garment in That Wedding Dress Photo?" Mm. Sort of illustrating that sometimes we look at a woman's dress and wonder if she's wearing her garment. And it then led to sort of this culture of judging that should we be really looking at a woman's wedding dress photo,
yeah,
or in this case, a photo for her ring ceremony, and wondering if she was wearing her garment. And it was a post that ended up getting picked up by LDS Living, and was part of the whole judgment culture. I was glad, Jana, that I never looked at her dress and wondered if that was her garment. Yeah, I was her bishop. Yeah, in some ways, I could have looked there, but I just saw the beauty of that day. I saw her father after the sealing, who was not able to be at the sealing, walk her down the aisle for this civil ring ceremony. And I just saw beauty. I wondered in this Facebook post, is it possible she was wearing the wedding dress of her own mother who did not grow up in the church? And that would not be a garment-friendly dress. I don't know if that's true, but her own mother was not in the church. And so it was just it's something that I think your research is pointing out. And I don't know where we got to this point where we obviously have this wonderful doctrine of obedience and a set of standards, but somehow we've then sort of see everybody by all that those rules that I agree in and believe in and invite people to live, but somehow we've quit seeing people perhaps with who they are and giving them space to be where they are and sort of see them by all these checklist rules, which I think is a lower level of ministering. Any follow-up thoughts on the judging from your perspective, Jana?
That's a great story, and it reminded me of a couple of media firestorms that ensued in Mormon world when Elizabeth Smart got married. She went on her honeymoon, and there was some kind of picture posted of her and her new husband in Hawaii, and she was wearing a dress that I think might have been sleeveless, and there was an uproar about that. There was also one during the election of 2012 when Ann Romney was wearing a dress, and people were wondering if she could possibly be wearing garments. Why are we wondering this? Yes, there's a lot of policing of certain boundaries around women's dress that contributes to this culture of judgment. That is certainly an area where we need to do some work. I am a believer in standards. I am a believer in the idea that there are certain things that we as individuals need to do in our lives that will help to bring us closer to God. It is not our job to police those standards for other people.
I love that. Someone on my social media feed said something, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, "My covenant keeping does not covenant to make sure you're keeping your covenants."
I like that. That's good.
Keep going through your research, Jana. This is very, very interesting.
Okay. Also for women, number two was that kind of top, I could no longer reconcile my personal values. That was the number one overall thing. But number three for women was the role of women in the church. I think that's significant. When you look at the data that is collected of current Mormons, we do see generational difference. We see that younger Mormons are certainly more interested in women's equality, in visibility, in women's leadership than older ones. But this is still a pretty conservative group. However, when you combine that with what we see in the data from the former Mormon women, it seems like the ones who were bothered by it left because of it. You know,
that's
the ones who, that there may be, in fact, a causative element here. And that, to me, should be indicative that we have something to work on in our culture. If that many women are feeling that our culture is not celebrating their, you know, contributions in a way that they feel good about, and in fact that the church may be the one area of their lives where they feel that they are not offered equal opportunity, which is something that I heard from a couple of women who I had interviewed. They don't feel equal in the temple, for example. Mm-hmm. And that chapter of the book was kind of painful to write about the temple because the data is both positive and a little bit alarming, particularly where women are concerned.
What would you say to people that would kind of, under this issue, say that all women who leave the church, it's really over the priesthood and their, and the fact they do not have the priesthood? Is it that simple, or is it much more complex than that?
It is more complex, certainly. And I wouldn't say that priesthood by itself is the deal breaker. In fact, for women that I interviewed, several of them said, I don't think that women need to have the priesthood in order to have more of a say in what goes on in church. The fact that, you know, women can't have a meeting in the building without a man just feels like women are infantilized in a way that is demeaning to women. And there are a lot of other things, too. Nylan McBain's work, which is, I think, something every bishop should read, Women in the Church. And she has a lot of ideas, excellent ideas in that book, of things that the church could do without changing doctrine, without giving women priesthood necessarily, things that we, in some cases, actually used to do in our history that we don't do anymore, and in some cases, things that we could do to accommodate women's leadership now that have not been done before but don't require priesthood. We're just not doing enough.
And it's interesting, as you talk about these things, you know, my framework as I approach these podcasts is making the church work for more of our members.
Yes.
And so I'm big tent Mormonism, not small ball. I want to play big ball, and I want our wonderful restored church to work for more of our members. And so when you go down this list, there's sort of this circle of doctrine that some members would want to change to make it work for members of our church, and I give them permission to feel that way. But most of what you're talking about doesn't change the circle of our doctrine.
Right.
Judgment is not about our doctrine. It's about how people feel. Tell that story I've heard you tell of the woman preparing for a talk. And
oh, yeah.
It's a pretty tender story.
Right. So one of the women that I interviewed, and the story is also told in the book, said that she was getting ready to give a talk in sacrament meeting and, you know, a little nervous, as you often are when you're about to give a talk. And so she was sitting up on the stand, and an elderly woman from the congregation came up and spread a coat over the young woman's legs because she said, your skirt is too short. You know, this is not right. And so imagine that. I see you wincing here, and, you know, it's just a little bit heartbreaking. You have this young woman, I think at that time she was college age, being shamed in front of the congregation for having a skirt that this person deemed too short for sacrament meeting. And if that conversation needed to happen at all, which I don't think it did, it should have happened off stage. And
yeah.
It's not our job, as I said before, to police one another's behavior. That woman is still in the church. If I'm remembering correctly, I'd have to go back and check my notes on each interviewee. I'm not Aaron Brockovich, you know. Somebody was joking with me. You have all these people in your head, but it's hard to keep the details completely straight.
We have the gift of great data and great research, so
maybe.
We like the way you're wired, Jenna.
Oh, maybe.
I think that's a good story, and I think it's helpful to process that story. Now, that story may not happen, but the principles behind that, I think, in a ward council or in a relief society or elders' quorum, we could talk about the principles behind that and what we need to do to make sure that or similar type activity doesn't occur.
Mm-hmm.
Judgment's a really tender one for me because it seems like that's just, you know, I don't know what the tennis analogy is. It's like a unforced error, I guess is the term.
Oh, in baseball. Or is that in tennis?
Is that in tennis?
Yeah.
We could ask our podcast producer if he's a tennis guy over
person.
There. But I think he's shaking his head too. Our listeners are laughing at us now, but that's okay. They can handle it. But this term, an unforced error, which I think is a tennis term, is sort of this idea that, you know, it's one thing to be beaten by the skill of your opponent. And I don't know who our opponent is. I don't want to make opponent for just the sake of it. But a lot of times it's our own unforced errors that cause people to leave.
Yeah.
Things that we should not have happened. And I think part of this podcast that's a tender space is talking about when we talk about the things that we've done that aren't, you know, that cause people to step away, I think it makes us better. So there's no attempt to sort of tear down the church or be negative in any way, but I think a lot of people are looking for thoughtful ways to better minister. And I think your research coming online with the ministering gives us a better insight. That's sort of the central point of what I think you're doing, is giving everybody that wants to understand people that may feel marginalized better understanding of why and tools to sort of reach and connect with them and help them. So other thoughts on your research, Jana?
Well, one thing that came up a number of times in interviews was the friction that can happen in families when one person either takes a break from the church or steps away entirely. And I was surprised by how many people were afraid to have that conversation with the people that they loved or who were kind of doing it on a rollout basis where you're going to tell this one person that you think is supportive and then maybe 6 months from now you'll tell this other person who may or may not be supportive. It's exceptionally difficult. You know, I didn't grow up in a Mormon family, so I don't have that personal basis of knowing viscerally how difficult it is to tell your parents that you're stepping away from the church. But having heard these stories again and again of young people who would like to have that conversation with their parents but feel like they're going to be shut down, it has kind of opened my eyes to the way that many people who are Orthodox Mormons are afraid to really truly listen to the reasons why other people have left the church. And I think that that is an area where we could do some good, deep listening and hard work.
I really agree with that. And I've shared this in a podcast before that I home taught a man in our ward that was active, and I home taught him for 4 or 5 years. This was probably 10 years ago. And I never thought to ask him why he stepped away. And I think if you admit you at the time, Jen, I would have said, I'm scared of going down that road with him. I'm not sure he wants to, but he probably would if he trusted me. But I was probably fearful of what I might learn that could potentially cause me to question. And I, but I think for some of our members, they may not, that may not be a road they're able to go on. It just may not be, they not be wired to have those conversations. But I think more and more of our members, especially our millennial members, are having these conversations all the time.
Yes, I think so.
And they need a framework to be able to have these conversations because they're having it all the time. I talk to my own kids that are at college age, and many of their friends are having these discussions. So they're having discussions that I never had at that age. And I think a whole category of ministering is, how do we minister to members that are stepping away?
If you were, I'm going to turn the tables and ask you a question, since you know you have a lot of experience to draw upon in the church. Thinking about your generation when you were maybe in your late teens and early 20s compared to what you see now in young people who are in their late teens and early 20s, what would you say the differences are?
One of the biggest differences I see is they're wired more for the people that are on the margins than I was. They see the world and they kind of start more with issues that are related to people that are marginalized and social issues along those lines. So that makes me never negative on this younger generation. Yeah, they might be on their phones, but I have such great faith in this generation because I think they see the world better than I do, and I think they're more wired like Christ was, is to see people on the margins. I think socially they're, I don't like to call them liberal or conservative. Those are triggering words if you're not in that group, so I don't want to use either of those labels, but that's one of the big things I see, is they're dedicated to causes. And sometimes there's friction within them because the causes that they see that are the most needed in the earth, our church isn't sort of connected to some of those causes. Poverty's one that our church is deeply connected to. But some of the other most marginalized groups, our church doesn't quite know how to participate in that space, like LGBTQ. So those are a couple things that come to mind. There's a real sense of fairness with this group that, and a real sense of equality. And these are all attributes that make me like the millennials more. I think they're more likely to see good in other places than our religion, and see joy outside of our religion and see goodness and truth. So they can be fully believing members, but also see the good and beauties of other religions and not have that be necessarily triggering to their testimony, their faith. It's less of a, another answer would be less of an us versus them narrative. I don't think they're as wired into the war themes. As a separate podcast, I talked about how my mission president sort of wanted to end that culture from the prior mission president, us versus them sort of war theme, where to accomplish our efforts as missionaries, we kind of had to find a bogeyman, So yes. We found it in the Church of England, and our new mission president didn't want to do that, and we ended up being much more effective missionaries. So I think, to answer your question, there's much less of a less us versus them. I think there's a feeling that, you know, we're all in this road of humanity together. Now there's sex traffickers and ISIS that are definitely the them.
Yes.
So those are just some thoughts that come to my mind, Jana.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about poverty and the heart that young adults seem to have for social issues. We, among the current Mormons in our survey, we asked them to rank 15 different issues that were facing America. And for older Mormons, the top issue was moral or religious decline, and also in their top five, changing views on the traditional family. So, you know, those are very much issues for older Mormons. We see this reflected in our church meetings and general conference. But the number one issue for millennials was poverty, hunger, and homelessness.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
That is really interesting.
So I think here's some good data confirmation of what you've observed anecdotally, that this is a generation that does care a lot about poverty. And, you know, this is a question for social scientists. Will that concern go with them as they age? Because people do tend to get a little more politically conservative as they grow older. But or will it become a hallmark of who they are as they mature?
It's a really good question. Keep walking us through your data. This is wonderful.
Okay, well, let's go back to reasons for leaving and think about it generationally, since we're talking about generations. For millennials, we did see a little bit of difference. You know how we saw that issue of feeling judged or misunderstood was in the top five for the whole sample, but it wasn't number one. For millennials, it was tied for number one, just as it was for all women. Feeling judged or misunderstood ranked tied for first with the I did not trust the church leadership issue.
So let me get that straight. For millennials, now we're talking men and women together, that was the number one reason I felt judged or misunderstood.
Yes, tied for first.
And tied for first with I did not trust the church leadership to tell me I can't read the truth of surrounding controversial issues. Walk our three readers through what a millennial is, just because some people have different age group definitions.
Oh, you're right. I should have done that at the beginning. Sorry. Roughly people born in the 1980s and 1990s. We have a little bit of fluidity at either end, but that's a good working definition.
So it's about a 20-year, two-decade 1980s and 1990s.
Roughly, yeah.
I'm definitely not millennial. I have full several decades, Jana.
Okay. I'm a Gen Xer. I'm right in the middle of Generation X.
I read those two reasons, Jan, and I still come back to those are solvable things without any doctrinal changes. I think this sort of assumption millennials are leaving over doctrine, and the only way we're going to keep the millennials is to change the doctrine, which I'm not advocating for, that is not a consistent narrative with the reality of the data you're polling. Mm-hmm. And this gives me hope that as we work on these, as we talk about these issues that you're raising and do a better job, we can keep more of our millennials. Have you talked about what percent of millennials are staying? And maybe that's later in your data. I don't know if you want to talk about that now, sort of the retention rate that you're seeing with millennials.
Roughly half. We get that from both Pew data and from the General Social Survey. The next Mormons survey is a one-shot deal. It's not longitudinal. So it's only when you have longitudinal data over a period of years and even decades that you can start to make long-term judgments about retention. But we do have some of that from Pew and from the GSS.
So interpret that. So 46% of millennials are staying. How is that determined? Like, how long were they in before we decided they left, and how long have they been left to be this 50% that are staying and not staying?
Well, okay, to be a little more optimistic, the 46% retention is from the General Social Survey, and it's from a very small sample.
And is that Mormons, or is that...
Yes.
Okay, so still we're talking Mormons.
And the way the GSS does it is to say, what religion were you when you were age 16, and what religion are you now?
Okay.
And of the millennials in the GSS who were Mormon at age 16, only 46% said that they were Mormon now. As the GSS is collected every year, We will have more people in that group and more data and a smaller margin of error. Right now, the margin of error for that is very high. So I try to be really cautious about that number. We also have from Pew a 62% retention rate for millennials. So what I've been telling people is somewhere between 46 and 62%, or roughly half, is what we're doing. But both of those studies agree that we used to keep more like 3/4 of our people.
Yeah, so my age group, all the people that identified at age 16 as Mormon, I'm 57. What percent, based on the data you're seeing, are still Mormon?
Between 70 and 75%.
So this is a big difference.
It is. And what's particularly discouraging about the data in the GSS about millennials is that they still have a whole lot of time in which to make that decision to leave. When we're looking at the longitudinal data and we see, okay, people born before 1943, 75% of them are still in the church. And that's a nice big cohort. I think that's a very reliable number. And then we see only 46% of people born in the 80s and 90s are still in the church. But think of all the decades they still have ahead of them in which they might leave. And yes, some of them might come back. I'm not as optimistic about that as I would have been in previous generations, just based on data that we have about marriage, data that we have about fertility, two things that are correlated with staying in religion. Both of those things are not happening as early or as often with millennials as they did in previous generations. So, you know, there are some reasons for concern.
How would you feel about this narrative that sometimes I pick up that the world is getting worse, more evil, Satan's reign is increasing, and so the decline of the world and the increase of Satan and these sort of last days, that's the reason millennials are not as active as my generation. Does that resonate with you, or does that seem unfair that we're sort of blaming this or assigning this to a declining world or the victory of Satan over our youth?
Yeah, I find that a painful rhetorical strategy, honestly. It removes much of the responsibility from our shoulders and conveniently positions them on the shoulders of this demonic being that we would like to believe every bad decision we make can be traced to. That's a bad sentence, but I think you know right. What I'm talking about. It's just too easy, and I don't like the way takes our own agency out of the equation. We've got agency here. I do think that it's statistically correct that we are living in a challenging environment for religion, and that what's going on in Mormonism, in fact, is not as bad as it is in some other religions. You know, as hard as that is to believe, we're looking at 4 in 10 young adults now saying that they have no religious preference, which is 4 times higher than it was when I was a teenager. You know, that's a huge social change in a relatively short period of time. So it's a very challenging environment. Even some of, if the church rolled out programs that were absolutely wonderful, if they started giving more visibility to women and ended the culture of judgment today, it might still not be enough to counteract what's going on in the general culture in terms of disaffiliation from religion. So that's my pessimistic side coming out, right? I would love to see all of those changes, of course, but we should be realistic about the environment that we're living in.
That's very thoughtful, and I like the holistic feeling there. Why are Mormons doing better then, in your feeling, than other religions of holding on, even though our rates are not as high as they used to be?
Because, well, it's complicated. Again, like everything in sociology of religion, it's complicated. But one of the factors that has been a plus for Mormons is that it is a quasi-ethnic religious group. That's, you know, quasi-ethnic is a term that has been bandied about, and I think it's a pretty good term. Mormonism is a tribe still, even though it is also a religion that relies heavily upon conversion. And that has been helpful for cohesion and for retention over the years. So that's one of the things. And we also do a bang-up good job of teaching our young people what we believe. We have seminary, which in our data we found to have an independently positive effect on retention. So people who graduated from seminary and had gone to seminary all 4 years, even if you take out all of the other factors, like that they were already in a strong LDS family, had strong church attendance, if you take all of that out, seminary still exerted a small, it was modest, but a modest independent factor that showed higher retention in adulthood. We also have the missionary program, which is a wonderful way of getting people to convert to their own religion. I think very highly of what we do with our young adults and giving them this opportunity to go volunteer, to make sacrifices, to prove themselves and prove their loyalty to their heavenly parents. I mean, it's a really kind of amazing program that we have.
That's very helpful. Keep going down your list. Tell us about 3, 4, and 5. And this back to our, for our listeners, these are reasons that millennials, Mormon millennials, have stepped away from our church.
Well, number 3 is particularly important, which is the church's positions on LGBT issues. This wasn't even in the top 10 when we surveyed the older Mormons who had left the church. It was number 6 for Gen Xers, but it had risen to number 3 in the millennial generation. Again, equality, inclusivity, those are the watchwords of this generation. And for them, this is their civil rights debate. This is the civil rights issue of their generation as they see it. And so it can be exceptionally challenging and difficult when they feel that their beliefs about LGBT inclusion and equality are at odds with their churches.
That's very helpful. Keep going.
Number 4 was the I could no longer reconcile my personal values question. Number 5 was I drifted away from Mormonism. Number 10 for millennials was the role of women. It was number 8 for Gen Xers. It was not, I believe, in the top 10 for boomers. Let me just take a look here. Yeah, it's not in the top 10 for the boomer silent generation.
So now I'm thinking, I'm imagining myself in a meeting. I know a few YSA stake presidents in the Valley and a few YSA bishops. I guess, Jen, I'm still in this YSA world.
Good.
Thinking
we need you.
About
That's good.
Men and women in this age group from 19 to 30. And I'm wondering if they're, you know, going through your 5 slides here. They've got, you know, maybe like my ward, 2/3 that are not active, 1/3 that are active, and maybe 1/3 that are, you know, that 1/3 that active, perhaps going through those things. Any thoughts on just taking this data and processing it into actionable stuff at a ward or stake, like the feeling of not being judged? Would you do talks on that? Would you do training on that? Role model specific examples? And that, I'm going to ask 2 questions at once. If you have any suggestions on the judgment and on the not trusting the church leaders to tell the truth, which about historical stuff, would you start to proactively teach the church essays at the YSA level in a Sunday school class? Because I think some wards are starting to do that, but a lot of wards are worried about starting a faith crisis and members that aren't aware of this complicated by content by actually starting to talk about the church essays that talk about some more of this complicated stuff. So any thoughts on just, if you had a bunch of YSA stick presents around and they said, Jana, help us. You've got the data and you've got the, you know, also the personal interviews and your own life experience. Any thoughts that come to your mind?
Well, I like the idea of specific training, anti-judgment training. I don't know what we would call it.
I like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure what we would call it, but to role model what it looks like when we are trying to be a non-judgmental people. And it's hard. I mean, I'm judgmental. I'm
Same.
A one on the Enneagram. That's our whole thing, is being critical of ourselves and holding everybody to a high standard. So I need that training. And this is an area where we don't have to rely on our own internal resources and try to reinvent the wheel, because other religions already have curriculum about this and other organizations have curriculum about this. We could do ourselves a big favor by trying to take advantage of what's already out there. And in terms of your second question about the trust gap with church leaders, I am aware that in some seminary situations, and I don't know how widespread this is, but the gospel topics essays are being taught to high school students. And they're also being taught in some BYU religion classes. This is such a great step forward. And Elder Ballard, I guess it was last year or perhaps the year before, gave a talk to CES instructors in which he basically said the old methods, throw them away. You know, we've got to up our game here, and we've got to be honest about our history with these young people. So more of that. I think it would be fantastic if these essays were taught at the local level. And people found out about these things at church where they can talk about them with faithful church members, because there are ways to understand some of our more controversial elements of our history or our theology that when you're trying to figure it out alone and you're Googling it at home, you know, in your basement past midnight, which no one should ever do on any topic, right? they can just seem so overwhelming when you're just by yourself.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I like those ideas. Let's go to LGBTQ, unless you want to talk any more about millennials, Jana, because I know you did a section on LGBTQ, both a crosstab of how that works for active people, what percent are LGBTQ, what percent are LGBTQ that have stepped away, and any other research you want to share with our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's think about changing attitudes toward homosexuality. We have seen in American culture this tremendous and relatively rapid shift in attitudes about homosexuality. Pew has been measuring this for a long time by asking a binary question: should homosexuality be accepted by society or discouraged by society? Which we repeated on our survey so that we could have comparable results. And it's interesting to see how there's generational difference clearly on this question, and also that all people, including Mormons, have come around to this idea. And that's been a pretty quick change. In our survey, we had a majority of millennials say that homosexuality should be accepted by society, especially the younger millennials when you divide them into older and younger members of the same generation. Whereas just over a third of boomer silent Mormons, baby boomers and silent generation members, said that homosexuality should be accepted by society. So that's a pretty big gap. We saw the same kinds of differences on questions of same-sex marriage, whether that should be accepted. And the overall acceptance for same-sex marriage is a little bit lower than it is for this general question about homosexuality. But still, we see generational difference.
That's very helpful. I think there's two narratives that people could weave into that, that it's the acceptance is part of a decline in our society and an acceptance of things outside of the boundaries of our doctrine. Or another spin on that, so to speak, would people becoming aware of the science behind sexual orientation. And I know that society in our own churches has shifted on that. And as we become better aware of the science, with the science teaching that sexual orientation is sort of hardwired into people as, you know, when they're born, then I think that could be part of the reason for this shift, is we're understanding better the science behind this.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you've got any follow-up thoughts on that.
We don't have any data specifically that asked people what might have made you change your mind about this. I thought that would be a really interesting question, but we didn't, unfortunately, have something like that.
And I certainly, as our listeners know, there's a lot of tension for active Mormons. I'm remembering the story of posting my thoughts about gay marriage, of sort of not advocating it. In other words, I don't invite people down that road. I'm not proposing that road. But if someone personally chooses to go down that road and practices a principle I'd call self-determination, that they choose for themselves the right path for them, then I'll support that. I'll go to their wedding. I like their social media posts. And so that's personally where I'm navigating that as a faithful member of the church. And I'm reminded the other day of posting that on social media, and a young man who I knew went to the temple that very day to sort of, how do I reconcile this? Am I getting soft on being Mormon? Because I'm okay with my friends that are going down this road, and I support them, but is that crossing a line? And he said my Facebook post was the first thing that popped up after he left the temple, and he felt like it was an answer to prayer.
Interesting.
Because he could navigate both of these. He could support individual people on the road that they felt was right for them, but also honor the doctrine of our church and the proclamation of the family. So I think sometimes people want to be binary in the sense you're either for us or against us, or you're either for the proclamation of the family or not. And certainly my feeling is I believe in the doctrine of the proclamation of family, and I'm not asking that to change, but I honor people with genuine joy in my heart if they choose a path that's outside of the doctrine that I believe in. And I can honor that decision for them, and that seems to be what Christ would want me to do. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be a doctrinal foundational principle that Christ, for what he taught, to love everybody, would I practice the doctrine of love at that point. But keep sharing more of your research with us, Jen, or any other thoughts you have.
Well, tell me specifically what you want to know about LGBT.
Tell us about one of the things I'm aware of is the percent of Mormons that are active that identify as LGBT, okay. And the percent of Mormons that have stepped away that identify as LGBT.
So among currently identified Mormons, people who still say that they are Mormon, about 5% are not heterosexual. So 95% heterosexual, basically 19 and 20 Mormons who are still considering themselves Mormons are heterosexual.
And that seems consistent with the data that I've seen.
Yeah, I think it is. For former Mormons, it's a little bit different. We saw more sexual diversity in the former Mormon population, which probably won't surprise many of your listeners. We had 87% heterosexual and 13% either gay or lesbian, that was 6%, bisexual, 5.5%, or other 1%.
Did that surprise you at all? Was that about what you expected?
It did not surprise me. Believe me, there were plenty of things in the data that surprised me, but this wasn't one of them. The idea that more people who are not heterosexual would be in the former Mormon population is not surprising. It's a very difficult row to hoe if you are a Mormon who wants to stay in the church, but you know that you are gay or you know that you are bisexual. It is very challenging and it's not for everybody. Yeah.
And to reframe that data the way Jana just said, I think it's about 1 in 20 active in the church identifies as LGBT and about 1 in 7 or 8 that have stepped away.
So 13%. Let's do some math here. Yeah.
Something like that.
This is why I have a calculator on my phone.
I don't either.
Right? So 13% are not heterosexual in the former Mormon population.
Yeah. And so that's a group that I think a lot about. I think, well, are they just less faithful?
No.
That would be a simple narrative. They can't hold to the iron rod. They're have the natural man, or they're, you know, all these sort of narratives. And I think our listeners are thoughtful enough to know that, just as you suggest, this is a pretty hard road.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. This is just a silly story, but
we like stories, Jana.
Okay. Well, I was having dinner before I was about to present this data to a group in California, and we were at a restaurant, an Asian restaurant that had cilantro in a lot of the food. And I hate cilantro. I can't stand it. To me, it tastes like soap and it's disgusting. For years, I thought that was just an idiosyncratic thing about me. And then some years ago, I came across this New York Times article about cilantro and how there is an actual DNA marker for people who have this thing where cilantro tastes like soap to them. And it's pretty small. It's like 5% of the population or something. Ding, ding, ding.
Wow.
If you were to tell me that I am morally degenerate because I was born hating cilantro, or that it tastes this soapy, disgusting way to me. I mean, it tastes like I've washed my mouth out with soap, right? I can only hear what other people say, that it's so fresh and it's delicious. In a tiny way, this is a similar thing. This is the way I was born, and I can't even imagine what it would be like for that to be a desirable taste, to have cilantro in something. It just seems so gross to me.
I love that story.
Okay, good. Well, it's a pretty trivial story.
I can think back of all the things I don't like and wonder if I have something going on. It comes back to this idea that science helps us make more thoughtful decisions sometimes than the non-scientific model,
right?
Whatever we call that.
It should. And it also, I hope, will engender compassion in us. I'm also left-handed. I had a fifth grade teacher who tried to make me right-handed. It was a really demoralizing and sad experience for me because I felt like I couldn't be what she wanted and thought was normal. I mean, if we can take some of these experiences, which seem trivial, and apply them to much more serious and important issues like LGBT issues, shouldn't it help us, shouldn't it engender compassion in us and help us understand that if you were born a certain way, that is how God made you, you know?
I really agree with that. Back to our group of local leaders, Relief Society presidents, bishops that have LGBT people in their congregation, or maybe don't think they do, but maybe should be talking about it. Any thoughts you'd give them from a ministering standpoint to create space or the right kind of conversations for our members that are LGBTQ?
Well, I would say for people who work with youth, be really careful of any offhand comments that you make. And even if they just seem to you like throwaway comments because you're assuming that no one in your group of youth could possibly be gay, statistically, yeah, actually, they're probably, if you have 20 kids in a room and they're all active in the church, you're going to have one, and probably you might have more because some of them might leave later. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So just assume that you have a mixed sexual orientation audience. Assume that all the time. Don't have code-switching language where you are speaking one way because you think that all Mormons are the same or that all of them will agree with you. You could wind up saying something very, very hurtful.
I really like that. And if you were try to, is there any other thoughts on things you could say that would be helpful versus just at least passing the bar of not saying bad things?
Right. That should be our
minimum,
low bar, our threshold.
Would be an improvement in some ways, in some areas.
It would. Well, I think assuming that everyone wants the same thing, assuming that we are on the same page as a church, that we want the church to flourish and to thrive, and that God has made us with great individualism and that that's a good thing, that's a really nice default position when we're encountering diversity in any context, whether it's sexual orientation or race, gender, whatever it is, that we each have something to contribute. All God's children got to sing in the choir. So that's true, but also, to answer your question about how do we raise the bar, share stories that are positive stories of LGBT people. Talk about things that are going on in your community in a positive way. One of the most heartbreaking interviews that I had and most beautiful was with a transgender woman who remembered watching the news with her parents when she was a little kid, and a transgender woman had been elected the mayor of some town. And the way her parents reacted was to say something like, oh, that's so disgusting. And here she was. She didn't have a word for transgender. She didn't know how to articulate the fact that she was born in a boy's body but had always wanted to be a girl and felt like she was a girl. But she completely internalized this attitude from her parents, like, oh, that part of myself must be wrong and disgusting. Just be careful.
Those are great suggestions. I think we're going to bring this podcast to a close. We like to do these for about an hour. Thank you, Jana, for all your research. We're really looking forward to your book.
Thank you.
And do you have any closing comments you'd like to give our listeners at this point?
No, I'm delighted to be here. The book will come out in March, and I'm hoping that the book will be a conversation starter for a lot of different kinds of conversations. That's the goal.
Thank you for doing this, Jana. I was at an event where you spoke at recently, and a faithful member of our church was talking about your research, and I heard him talk to whoever he was sitting by and says, we were just sitting in elders' quorum talking as we counseled together why people left, and we were all kind of speculating reasons, but I think that's where one of the things that you're doing is so helpful. You're giving us the data on why people leave, and why then I think it helps us to keep people in that might follow that same path if we know the pressure points or the tension points. And I love this idea of ministering, but I think we can talk about ministering and lay out principles, but I think the next step of that is then extend it to some of these groups that we're talking about that are vulnerable, that are attending or have left, and so we can bring them back. I think our listeners know I love our church. I believe its truths are universal, but I recognize that we're losing some of our best members, not because of the things you talked about, Janet, at the beginning, the sort of the simple narrative, but because of the complex things they're dealing about that your research is highlighting. And I sometimes help people with marketing and I think we always want to understand the consumer data behind mm-hmm. what is going on, and that helps us then develop much more thoughtful solutions. And so I love the work you're doing. I think it helps us to look inward and understand how we can do better. And I think it all fits together with this ministering umbrella. But to truly minister, I end with this idea that the shepherd knew his sheep well enough, all 100, that he knew the story, and he knew that if one left, he knew why. And and I guess the shepherd could be female. Do we have female shepherds?
I'm sure we do.
To some of this gender stuff as I'm trying to improve. The shepherd would know where to find. And to find, we need to know the story, and we need to learn how to hear those stories, because then we'll be more effective of keeping people in. And I love also this idea that we can maybe keep space for people to stay in, not all aligned with everything from a cultural standpoint, from a belief standpoint, from a behavioral standpoint. I love the idea that the congregation should be safe and welcoming for everybody. There really shouldn't be a belief or behavior hurdle to feel welcome in a Mormon congregation. That's what Christ taught. I've always thought there's no narrowing at the gate at the congregation level. I think that can happen at the temple. And that's maybe where there's much more of a belief hurdle and a behavior hurdle, but I think the congregation needs to be safe and welcoming for all our members, and Christ would meet them where they are, give them permission to be where they are, and help them feel whole and complete just where they are. No shame, you know, and he would give them hope that you've talked about and a feeling that they're okay and they can move forward in this faith at their own terms, on their own speed. Mm. And so I think I love that, and I love the data that you're giving to help that conversation take on an added dimension with the research we're providing. So thank you, Jana.
Thank you.
For joining us.